And if you would please help me welcome Allison B. from Tucson, Arizona.
Lots of water. Hi, y'all. I'm Allison Adams, and I am an alcoholic. Used to be Butterworth Adams, so that's where the B comes from. I am really grateful to be here, y'all, and thank you for being here. I am so excited. Lee and I had talked about this almost 2 years ago, coming to see y'all, and then something happened and put us in a delay. But congratulations to all of you who are celebrating tonight. It's really good to be a part of the enthusiasm and excitement of Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. And thank you, Carrie. I flew into LA yesterday, and Carrie and I drove up the coast, and we got some free entertainment and solving from the Christmas tree bonfire. That was really cool. And we're just having a great time, and I'm just so glad to be in a live meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They've resumed in Arizona, too, but there's an awful lot of Zoom going on. Some people seem to appreciate that. But I'm glad to be here. I'll never say that I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm just grateful that I have a solution to this thing called alcoholism. And when I got here, I didn't know for a long time what was really wrong with me. I didn't understand what alcoholism was, you guys. I know that when I got here, I knew that I couldn't seem to manage my drinking. And I knew I was the girl that would come to the party with a fifth of Jack under my arm, and I'd be fist pumping to the heavy metal in the room, personal favorite. And I knew I was a bit loud. But I didn't know what alcoholism was, and I'm glad that I know that today. Alcoholics Anonymous seems to be the perfect solution to this thing that I suffer from. You know, when I came in here, I walked in here with a broken spirit, and AA has given me a solution in order to put me back together. And I just want to tell you a little bit about what it was like the day I got here. I was 27 years old. It was September of 1992. And I came to my first meeting. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with the intent to get sober on Friday night of September 25th of 1992. And what had happened to me that day is I had prior to that been drinking and doing things for 3 days. Prior to that, I had been hanging out with my sister in West Los Angeles, and we were just out to have a good time, you guys. We were going to get in the car, go to Palm Springs, work on our tan poolside at some cheap hotel in Palm Springs, but we never quite got there, you see. My sister had, we were drinking at a bar, and we ran into this guy that was in a rock and roll video. Who remembers Skid Row? I know you do. So, there's this guy from this rock video, so of course we wanted to hang out with him, and we were going to go out to Palm Springs to drink, and that didn't happen. We ended up meeting this guy and partying and drinking for 3 days. And on the fourth morning when I came to, I had to be at work that day. I was working as a bartender on the Santa Monica Pier, and I was going to work a swing shift that day. And I came to with some truths about myself, you guys. I was absolutely terrified. I was crying my eyes out. I knew someone in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I contacted her. And she answered the phone when I needed her the most. It was about 10:30 in the morning. And I called her because I knew this to be true about myself that morning. Is number one, there was nothing I could do to not take a drink that day. That left to my own devices, that I had no ability. I was completely powerless over whether I was going to drink or not. I knew that I had finally lost that choice. I knew that was true. And the second thing that I knew was true about me that day was that there was absolutely nothing I could do to change the way that I was living. And that left to my own devices and without some type of intervention, I was going to continue to live the life I was living that day and the next day and the next day after that. And the level of despair and terror, I think is an appropriate word in this, that drove me to, motivated me to take an action that I had not taken in the 12 years since I had started drinking. What that was that I called someone and asked them for help. And fortunately for me, as a bartender, I knew this woman. She was a drunk. She had been my best drinking buddy for some time before she got sober. She had been in a drunken driving accident. She did a little jail time. She had to pay a lot of money because she had injured some people in that accident, and she was sober. And so when I needed her the most, she had been sober 3 years. She was quite active in Alcoholics Anonymous in Hollywood. And she, you know, if you know the responsibility pledge, she had extended the hand of AA to me. And she had often tried to entice me with all the funny stories and the things that y'all talk about in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't want to be around you guys. Y'all took my friend. You didn't drink. I didn't trust you. But she had always made sure she was available to me, and she kept in touch with me. And I saw that her life was getting better. You know, she went back to school. She was taking action in AA. She made commitments and she kept them. And I saw her life getting better, but I was afraid of you guys. But on that day that I needed you so desperately, she answered the phone and she talked to me about going to a meeting. But what she first said to me, she goes, "What time are you working today? I'll come down and see you at lunch." And she said specifically that time at lunch, whether it was noon or one, I don't really remember. And she showed up at the door of that restaurant on the Santa Monica Pier. And the greatest example you were to me at that moment is when she walked into the front door of that restaurant. It was an old British pub. And she was just as graceful and beautiful as I had ever seen her. She had these crystal white eyes. She was tall, blonde. She had been successful as a model. She was from London. She had been quite successful in that industry. So she was beautiful anyways. But she had such a grace and poise about her. And the fact that her eyes were clear, I'll never forget it. And that was the example of what sobriety looked like on someone that had a little time under their belt. And she came in and she sat down with me and she suggested that I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that I needed to. I didn't go that day because I knew that I had to work a split shift, but I did go to a meeting the next night. And I went the next night to my first meeting where I wanted to be sober. I had been to a meeting once before with no intention of getting sober. And I found myself at the Beverly Hills Rodeo Drive meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I was trying to sneak in there because I knew that anybody in Beverly Hills wasn't going to let this piece of white trash into their meeting. That's how I felt about myself. I was quite known for my spandex pants, spiked leather boots, purple push-up bras, and black motorcycle jackets, and that's how I went to that meeting. And oddly enough, they thought I was new, but I went into that meeting, and there was a foyer, an outdoor foyer in this Romanesque church, and there were people talking to one another. And I don't know about you, when I got here, it was one of the great fears that I couldn't admit, which is, I don't know how to talk to you when I'm not drinking. I don't know how to have a conversation with you. And I walked into that church, and I'm dressed like I just described, and there, off to my left, there were these three men talking to one another. And they weren't the kind of men I hung around, because one of them turned around, and he had this sandy blonde hair that was just beyond his ears, and he was wearing this sport coat that was a camel color with these brown leather patches on the elbows. He wore these khaki slacks that had a pressed crease down the middle, as if he took the time to iron them or actually had them dry cleaned. And I don't hang around people like that, but I've never forgotten him. And he turned around and he said to me, he goes, "Hi, my name is so-and-so. How long are you sober?" I said, "Today's my first day." He said, "Well, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And as I had always thought when a man talked to me, my first thought was, he wants me. I know it. I know that he wants to be with me, and we'll just look for him after the meeting. That never happened, you know, and I couldn't have been more wrong about him having any interest in me except for maybe my well-being as a sober member here. But that was my first meeting where I did not take a drink after that day. But I will tell you this, after that meeting, and when I was driving back to the west side of LA, I thought it was necessary to help me sleep that night. I stopped at Save on Drugs, and I picked up some over-the-counter sleep medication. And I took as much of that as I could stomach and to help me get to sleep that night. So when I did my first inventory several months later, I knew that I needed to change my sobriety day, because I defined my sobriety as taking nothing that affects me from the neck up. And so I celebrate this the 26th of September today. I'm going to back up and tell you a little bit about what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, like what happened. You know, I grew up in Alvin, Texas. Nobody knows where that is, unless you're an old baseball fan and you knew Nolan Ryan. But I grew up in this little farming town in Alvin, Texas. I had these two sisters and this brother. We fought incessantly. We were in family counseling when we were young because we were so violent towards one another. And I think the ism had started then, but I didn't know that I had an allergy to alcohol. I just knew that people were a threat to my existence. My siblings were a threat to the attention I demanded from my parents. And from as far back as I can remember, I never quite fit in or quite belonged to the world around me. I was never good enough. I was always comparing myself to other people. So from the get-go, as far back as I can remember, if you were a female on this earth, I wanted nothing to do with you, because you were competing with any attention that I was trying to demand or command from either my parents, from men, or what have you. The self-loathing in me was profound and long-lasting for a long time, and thank God Alcoholics Anonymous can treat something like that. by the time I got to 15 years of age, the family counseling didn't work, didn't know how to be honest with those doctors. And I was very active in the Methodist church when I was a kid. I thought, when I got to AA, I thought this God thing, no big deal. You know, I was in the church choir 15 years ago. You know, I was in the youth group. But I had long abandoned church by the time I found you guys. But I thought, me and God were like this. Hadn't taken any action to have that kind of relationship with God for quite some time. May 29th, 1980, I was 15 years old. My best friend, Beth, her father was a Presbyterian minister in town, and they were out of town, and so we planned this party at her house. And, you know, I have an older sister who used to drink. My sister would go to keg parties down at the bayou, and my sister got to be quite well known amongst the football team in town. That's all I'm going to say. And I wanted to be popular like my sister. I just didn't know what she was up to. I just knew that people knew my sister and I was Kirsten's little sister. So I wanted to be popular too. And I was so self-centered, but that's not the word I knew then. I was just acutely aware of myself. You know, when I was around other people at school, all I knew was that I wanted to know what you were thinking about me. And if I stand like this, is that wrong or should I stand like this? And are you looking at that giant zit on my forehead right now? Because I had 100 of them all over. And I just was incredibly insecure and completely consumed with what I thought you were thinking about me all the time. So I planned this drunk, and I did not know that alcohol was going to be the solution to that type of feeling and thinking. All I knew was that I wanted to be popular like my sister. So at the end of at that party in May 29th of 1980, I got a bottle of Strawberry Hill. I wanted Tickle Pink. One of the older kids got me a bottle of Strawberry Hill. Amen to that. And I drank that bottle of Strawberry Hill behind one of the bushes by the front door, and I found the magic of alcohol, you know? Alcohol filled every hole in my soul, you guys. It absolutely provided me with the needed power to live. And I did not know that's what I was lacking in my life. I got a hickey that night, and I had arrived, and it was kind of, I kind of just did that every time I drank until I got to AA, really. But I had such a good time. I danced in front of other people. I felt like you were quite lucky to know me, between you and I. I just didn't have to tell you that, you know? And that was the year also I became cheerleader at high school. Becoming a cheerleader was the solution to the fact that I felt so badly about myself. And when I made cheerleader, I knew that we can all rest assured that we all know I'm now better than you. So let's just acknowledge that. And I would go to the t-shirt shop in Alvin, Texas, and I'd have it put on the back of my shirts. Cheerleader, Alvin High School. I didn't have many friends. I went back to my 35th high school reunion 2 years ago, and oddly enough, people didn't really want to talk to me still, 35 years later. I don't know what I did to them, but clearly I wasn't making friends. Anyway, so the separation between me and the people I went to school with happened pretty quickly after I started drinking. I didn't stay cheerleader all the time for the rest of my high school career. I started drinking, you know. I started going, now the drinking age in Texas at that time was 19, and I was getting in the car, and I was driving 35 miles up Highway 288 to go into Houston, go to nightclubs. My sister and I used to go, and I've never gone to a nightclub that didn't allow young women in there, whether it was legal or not, and that's what we did. You know, partying in the city of Houston, up to no good, doing things we shouldn't have been doing, and lucky we didn't get picked up and go to jail for something. But that was my life, and I thought it was exciting, and I thought that I was better than everybody else, and that was fine with me, you know. And so when I was 18 years old, I planned to move to Los Angeles. There was this singer from this band. I was a big rock and roll fan. And there was a singer of a band, and I was so obsessed with this guy, I was going to move to L.A., and I was going to marry him. So I applied to this fashion school in Los Angeles, and I knew that David Lee Roth was going to be in L.A. somewhere. I know we know some people who know what I'm talking about. And I was going to go out there, and I was going to marry him. He just didn't know it yet. And so I applied to school. I got accepted at this fashion school, and I moved to Los Angeles in 1983. I lasted in that school about 2.5 months. I did not have any intention of going to college. I just needed to use it as a vehicle to manipulate my parents to pay my rent every month and to give me a reason to get to L.A. What I came to understand in the time that I was out there and dropped out of college is that I was terrified, you guys. I didn't have any skills for living. I was, any moral lessons that my parents tried to instill in me had long since been removed since I started drinking. You know, I was out to look for the fun. I was out for excitement, and that's what I pursued. I was living right outside of downtown Los Angeles on Wilshire Boulevard and Rampart. And I was in an ethnic minority in the neighborhood I lived in. And the reason I bring that up is that it became very easy for me to find people to party with me and pay for things. And my roommate was from Seattle, Washington, and she was a blonde like I was. And it became very simple for us to get booze at Al's Market on Rampart and load up the liquor bottles in the apartment, and we'd get on the bus and drive up to Hollywood and go to nightclubs up there. I thought that my life was thrilling and exciting. It was, in hindsight, it was really degrading. It was embarrassing. It was humiliating. I let people take advantage of me. If whoever was paying for things was the one who got to call the shots. I often found myself at somebody's home over in the San Fernando Valley wondering how in the heck am I going to get out of here, you know, and taking cabs over the hill or trying to peddle money off the people I was hanging out with to find rides home. And I just was, I didn't have the ability to stand up for myself. I didn't have the ability to say no to people. I just desperately needed you to give me the attention. I just needed you to pay attention to me and make me feel like I was okay. And alcohol helped me feel okay, you guys. It just did. And I dropped out of school, and I'm just hanging out in the bars. I went back to Texas for a while. That was short-lived. I was back there in 87, 88 or so. And I got involved with people like I was drinking with in Los Angeles. Nothing got any better there. I got involved in quite a violent romantic relationship. Love. And that became quite violent. And he was selling drugs out of the apartment, and I ended up catching a ride with somebody and going back to California. I don't know who this guy was. He had been a bar customer at a restaurant my sister worked at, and I made it to LA safely, thank goodness. So I get back to LA and I start working at the Santa Monica Pier as a bartender, and that's where I stayed for the next 7 years until I found you guys, and I was there for even a little while after that. But I'm the girl that would go up to the 2nd Street and 3rd Street Promenade, and I would go to the bars, and I would do favors for the bartenders if they would give me free booze. I'm the girl that would, we would chase the homeless people out of the restaurant, but I'd end up partying with them at the end of the pier because I didn't want to drink alone. I would give away alcohol to people that would sit at the bar and talk to me, and if they would tip me, I would pour heavy, and so I was stealing from my employer, and I'm surprised I never got fired, and I did not know how to live with any type of life skills. And I really needed to stay inebriated as much as possible because I hated myself. I did not know how to function. I knew, and I was clear to me that I did not have the ability to make something of my life. There had been hope, I knew. I knew that there could have been something happening with my life that wasn't the way that it was. But I couldn't seem to do anything to change the way that I was living. And it just seemed to get darker and darker. You know, I'm the girl that goes to a bar in Hollywood, and when the lights come on at 2:15, I take whoever's left. You know, and I remember waking up the next morning and getting a ride home, and the guy put me in the trunk of the car, and I had to yell the directions through the peephole. He had a sports car because his friend wanted to ride in the front seat. So in order for me to get a ride, I had to go in the trunk, but I got to yell at him directions back to Santa Monica. And I'm the girl that at 2:15 in the morning, the lights go on. What are we going to do now? You know, where are we going to party? Some guy, he said he was a hairdresser, and he said, I'll give you a ride back to Santa Monica. And we go down the street, Sunset Boulevard, we go up to Heaney, and he assaults me. And I end up getting pushed out onto the concrete, wearing half of what I started with, and I had to hail a cab walking back down to Sunset Boulevard and looking for a ride, and this cab driver took pity on me and gave me a ride back to Santa Monica. I didn't have any money. But that's the kind of stuff I did, you guys. I just, please someone take care of me, because I refuse to take any accountability for myself. Do what you have to. You know, when I was in that relationship in Houston before I came back to LA, and that guy was, when things got really ugly and frightening, I remember jumping out of a moving car going down to Galveston Island. You know the shell shops down there off the piers? I ran into a retail shop and I hid behind the counter, and the owners are looking at me like, what are you doing? But I didn't want him to find me because he had been smacking me around in the car. And I remember thinking that this may be violent, but at least he knows who I am, right? The reason he beats me up is because he has to, because I thought so little of myself, and if he leaves me, there's going to be nobody else, so I might as well just put up with it. I remember getting to that point. And it's hard for me to believe now that that's the way I was living my life, but that's what I was doing. And so when I was back in Los Angeles, you know, it leads up to what I just told you about how I came to AA. You know, it gives you a snapshot of the person that came here. The first time I came to a meeting when I didn't get sober, I had a roommate that got a DUI and he was told he had to go to some meetings. So I got all dressed up and I was wearing, I'll never forget it. It was in February of 1992, several months before I got sober. And I walked into the Marina Center in Culver City and I was wearing a black turtleneck and black slacks. And I remember walking into the back of that meeting and looking around, and I thought it was like, remember the old E.F. Hutton commercials? You know, I thought when I entered the room that everybody stopped and looked, you know. But I didn't stay sober that night. I wasn't ready to hear the message. It was that day I described to you in September of 1992 when my friend Tish came and carried the message to me and gave me her time and shared her experience with me and spoke the language of the heart that got me to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm forever grateful to her for that. Unfortunately, she didn't stay with us. You know, she drank some years later. So here we are, we're in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I started going to meetings on the west side of LA, and I was living, my father had passed away on Valentine's Day of 1992. He died of an illness called Lou Gehrig's disease. You know, and when my father died, he had been sick for 3 or 4 years at that time. He was back in Texas. He had been an aerospace engineer with NASA. I had a lot of admiration for my father, but him and my mother had divorced and I didn't see him that often. And when he died, I had cashed in the ticket before he had bought me a plane ticket to see him in January of 92, a month before he passed. And I cashed in that ticket so I could keep drinking. And at the time, I was working at the Hollywood Tropicana. Any female mud wrestler attenders? I was working at the Hollywood Tropicana. I was working at the Hollywood Tropicana as a cocktail waitress. My roommate was a mud wrestler, and I didn't, you know, I told my dad I can't get out of work. I didn't tell him what kind of work I did, and I didn't go home. I wanted the money from that ticket, and at the time I was able to cash that in. And so he died on February 14th, and I used that get you to feel sorry for me, you know. Then the LA riots happened in March of '92, right? And I remember sitting on top of a building in Santa Monica down by 2nd Street and just smoking pot like crazy and just looking at all the plumes of smoke down towards South Central. And there was a curfew, so I was was breaking the law by being out and about. But so I just used, I don't know if there's any other victims here, but I came in AA as a victim and I lived as one in AA for quite some time. But everything bad that happened in my life wasn't really my fault. You just don't understand. You know, I'm really a nice girl. You just don't quite understand. You know, you caught me on a bad day. And I just always thought it was people, places, and things that were the cause of my poor fortune, you know, the miscalculations. And that just wasn't the case at all. I got to learn about that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I got here, I started going to meetings on the West Side. And then after my father passed, I got a little money from that. And I bought myself a car. I'm living across from Venice High School off of Venice Boulevard in Walgrove. And I'm going to meetings in Hollywood because there's a lot of cute guys in Hollywood, you guys. There's like the musicians meeting on Tuesday night. And I needed to be there. So I was going to meetings in Hollywood, and I was really here looking for a date for quite some time, you know. And I remember hearing that it doesn't matter what the motive is when you first get here, just keep coming. And I will say this, that is probably true. I'm glad that I just kept coming. It wasn't until later that the despair that came about as a result of not taking action in AA, not being sponsored, not taking the steps, not practicing the traditions, not getting involved by taking commitments, at 2.5 years of not drinking and going to meetings at my convenience, that drove me to a level of despair that I had never experienced in my life when I finally asked for help and was willing to give someone the authority to impose their structure, order, and discipline in my life, my sponsor. That changed my life for the better. But I want to tell you how I met my sponsor. It was 1995. I had been going to meetings. I was now back at the pier bartending. I left there, and then I went up to the 3rd Street Promenade to a high-end pool hall. And I'm tending bar, getting home at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd crawl out of bed sometimes at 11:30 and crawl over to 26th and Broadway, the noon 12:15 meeting. And, you know, I'm the girl that was a great example of a bad example of a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I did is I wasn't being sponsored. I asked women once in a while, and I wanted them to be my friend. But they got tired of listening to me moan and complain about the misery of my life. And I would go to that meeting, and it was smoking and non-smoking. I'd sit on the non-smoking side. I took my first commitment standing at the door and body-hugging the men. I had gotten into body piercing at that time because I needed a little excitement. So I would wear like a sports bra, a wife beater that I had tied in a knot in the back, and Daisy Duke shorts, and I was the greeter at the door. And you could see the piercings down the front of my body. I'll just leave it at that. And I wanted to be a part of, right? You were going to pay attention to me if it's the last thing that's going to happen at this meeting today. And I dressed that way. I spoke that way. I was offensive when I got the chance to share. And I was the girl who at 5 till 12, I couldn't go to the bathroom then. I couldn't get a coffee then either. No. It was 12:15 after the meeting started that I absolutely have to get up now and get that cup of coffee and go to the bathroom and walk straight down the center of the aisle so the guys can check out the merchandise in hopes of a date after the meeting. And that was my tools for living that I brought in here. It was the old ideas I was living by. And fortunately, no one was offering. But I kept trying to push that old idea. And that kind of behavior and showing up late and leaving early, I made no interest in meeting other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd only been sponsored because a couple of women took pity on me and offered to help me. And that's what happened. And that's where I was at 2.5 years of not drinking and being an embarrassment of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous when I met my sponsor. And thank God when the student was ready, the teacher appeared. And what happened for me is I used to see this man come into the meeting, and he had 16 years of sobriety at that time. And he would come in the room, and he was really jovial and friendly, and he would shake everybody's hand, and everybody would say, "Hey, Wayne's here, and they would go shake his hand. And he always got called on to share because he was kind of self-deprecating and funny at the podium. And he seemed to have this understanding of alcoholism that I had never heard people talk about before. And I was very interested, and there was an attraction I had to him. What I came to later understand is he had a power greater than himself that was working in his life. He was living AA as a way of life, and I was attracted to that. I just didn't know that's what it was at the time. And I asked him in March of 1995, "Will you please, you know, can we grab a cup of coffee and will you talk to me?" And he said, "Sure." Now, in the back of my head, I'm like, well, it's a man, so I'll just manipulate the heck out of him. Maybe I can get him to take care of me. That's what I'm thinking too. But we went down over to Marina Del Rey to Joni's Coffee Roasters, and at Joni's Coffee Roasters, they had these little coffee mugs that are clear glass, so you can see through the water through this mug here. And Wayne drinks black coffee, and he said, "Allison, can you see through the bottom half of this coffee mug? It's black coffee there. Can you see through that?" I said, "No, I can't." He goes, "Allison, right now that's your sobriety." He goes, "I bet you don't know that on page 55 of the big book, it states that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, though it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, and by worship of other things." He goes, "That's you, Allison. That's where you're at." He goes, "You are obscured. But if you come and do what we did and still do, you can recover too." And I knew in that moment that man knew exactly what was wrong with me. And he didn't speak to my head, but he spoke to my heart. And I knew that he had something that would help me. But I was really afraid to ask him to sponsor me. One, because men don't sponsor women, right? Women don't sponsor men, right? That wasn't going to work for me. And what happened is that I didn't ask him to sponsor me right away. And I left that meeting with some hope. I also had a couple of Pantera tickets. I was not going to miss that show to save my life, nor did I. And they were with Typo Negative out in San Bernardino. That was a great show. But I took a newcomer with me, and he got drunk, and I didn't care. You know, I just wanted someone to go with me. My first thought is never, what can I do for you? It's never, how can I help you? It's all, you know, I need some company, so I'll take you, and I don't care what happens to you. And that's exactly what happened. But when I got back from that concert, I went back to work at, I was working at a Mexican restaurant, UCLA. And I got busted for serving a minor, you guys. There were some undercover cops there, and I had served a 20-year-old a beer, and he wasn't 21 yet, and I never asked for his ID. And they shut the restaurant, they shut the bar down, they closed it down, they sent me home, and the next day I got fired. And because of my lack of action in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know who to call except that man, Wayne. And I asked him if he would please help me. He said, well, you know what? I'm getting in the car. I'm speaking out in Palm Springs this weekend. If you want, you can come out there and stay with the other women I sponsor, and you can come and do what we do. And my first response was, did you not hear what I said? I just got fired, and I don't have any money, and he hung up on me. And I thought, well, he's just, he has no compassion. How dare he? So I called him back. And he said, that's where we'll be. If you want to come out there, if you can get there, you can stay with the girls. Don't worry about it. Just get out there. So I dropped, I had a Jack Daniels jar, $50 worth of quarters. I put that in my pocket. I got in my little Datsun B210 pickup truck, and I drove to Palm Springs. And it was Easter weekend out there. It was the whatever roundup they have there around Easter in Palm Springs. And I remember going to that roundup that weekend, and Wayne, there was a guy that was taping that event named Chuck, and I would stand behind the table with Chuck and help sell CDs when I could in between the meetings. But when I got there, I saw Wayne. He goes, you know, call these girls. They're in their room. You can go meet up with them. And I met those women that he sponsored, and I thought, oh, no, I met them. I thought, oh, no, it's those women. I hate those women. You know, those are the women that they take commitments in AA, like they're greeters. They take commitments. They get there early. You know, they act like ladies. You know, when they do a high-profile commitment, which I define like as a basket, secretary, commitment chair, like they would dress up and show some respect here. And I'm like, oh, no, not them. But they, you know, they let me stay with them. I didn't have to pay for that room because I didn't have any much money. I paid for my own food. And I went to the conference that weekend. And what I remember on Sunday morning towards the end of the conference, there was a guy named Earl H. speaking that Sunday morning. And I was standing behind the tapers table trying to help the tapers sell tapes. I was in that same garb. I was in a t-shirt and shorts. And he said, well, why don't you put on something different? Why don't you go in there to the meeting and actually listen to the message? And that's what I did. And what happened at the end of that meeting, at the end of the conference, is they had a raffle. And I had pulled a ticket. And I was one of four people that got to go to the front of the room and pull an Easter egg out of a basket. And I pulled the Easter egg, and in there was $100 bill, and I won. And it was such, it always makes me emotional. It's like, at that moment, I knew that God was probably going to take care of me because I needed food that week. And it was just such a small thing, but it meant so much to me. And it started me on a road that got me to where I am today, because after that conference, I asked Wayne if he would sponsor me. And he says to me, he's like, are you willing to do as I say as long as it's not illegal, indecent, or immoral? And are you willing to take direction without debate? Well, that was easy to say yes to until I had to implement it, right? It's like, yes, I will. And then I think I grew to hate that man with every fiber of my being within the next 30 days, because no one had ever told me the truth about myself. You know, he said, here's what you're going to do. He goes, you're going to attend 7 meetings a week. You're going to have a commitment at least 6 of those meetings. I want you to get at every meeting at least 30 minutes early. I want you to make a point of saying hello to the newcomer. And please, under all conditions, leave the men alone. Stay away from them. And I said, okay. He goes, and then I want you to quit dressing like a tramp and start dressing like a lady and show some respect to this thing that might change your life. What an order. Can't go through with it. So here's, and of course, you know what my thought is I'm like, I don't have a job. I ended up getting a job at Kinko's. Who remembers Kinko's? I got hired in May of 1995. I had an AA sister working there, and I got hired for $6.50 an hour. And I ended up moving in with those women I hated. And they let me, I got to share a 3-bedroom apartment with them, pretty much sitting right on top of the 405 freeway. We paid $8.50 a month back then, and we had commitments in our apartment. Every week we rotated cleaning jobs. And I thought, are you kidding me? Not only do I have to have structure in AA, but now you're going to make me do something in my apartment. I was incredibly defiant, not that I'm still not at times, very belligerent, contrary, passive-aggressive, potty mouth, you know, and they tolerated me. And what I couldn't understand is why they kept laughing at me all the time, but they understood, like they had been where I had been. And they were given direction to tolerate me and try to teach me and show me how to live a different way. And I, you know, it didn't take long, a year or so, but I grew to absolutely adore and love those women for the time that they gave me and for the example that they set of being a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's what I did. And I didn't, you know, I didn't have any money. So I started going to Goodwill to buy my wardrobe. And I still love thrift shopping. And I would go, I remember we were in Mar Vista over by, over near Culver City by the Marina Center, and there was a Payless shoe store. And I was told to wear something other than sneakers with my new dresses. And I went over there to buy a pair of sandals. And I went up to the counter and I was going to write a check. I don't even know if it was good or not, but I was going to write a check to pay for it. And the guy behind the counter is like, "Ma'am, we don't take checks here." "What? What do you mean you don't take checks here?" "I don't have anything else." "Ma'am, we don't take checks. You're going to have to, you know, you can come back tomorrow again." I said, "No, I will not." And I took this big wad of bubble, double bubble, and spit it out on the counter and smeared it all straight across the cashier, the sales counter, and I walked out of the store. Unfortunately, one of those AA sisters was with me. And somehow my sponsor got wind of my actions. And I got to learn how to do an inventory, and I got to learn how to go back and make amends to that young guy, and treat him with some respect, you know. And then I got to pay for those shoes as well. But learning how to behave in an appropriate manner socially was a task that was left to my sponsor. You know, how to, I remember, you know, I became a member of the Pacific Group. He says, "I want you to go to the meeting that I go to every Wednesday," and that's what I did. And I was terrified. There was more than once that I walked into that room, for any of you that have been there, where I thought I was gonna pass out when I was new there because I was so terrified. And I started learning, you know, go up and just say hello to people, ask them how they're doing. Don't talk about yourself, just ask how they are. And let them start the conversation with you. And I learned how to do that. And I learned how to get a commitment. And I was in this room full of people where they were getting the same kind of direction I was getting. Get to the meeting early. You know, talk to the newcomer, thank the people who speak from the podium, you know, and try to and socialize and get to know other people during the break. And so I did that, and I started to feel safe there. And I started to learn how to behave like a decent member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember I was 5 years sober, and I stood in the back of that meeting by the coffee pots, and I just remember looking in that room and thinking, it was the first time that I could identify that I felt a true sense of joy in my life. I had never had that experience before. I felt that I did belong, that I did fit in, that I was a part of something greater than myself, you guys. You know, I kept bugging my sponsor to let me do my 4-step because I was convinced that once I did my inventory, that if he would just let me do that, that I would be cured. I'm sure no one else has ever had that thought. And that's what I did. After some time, when he felt I was ready, he put me in my 4-step after doing 1, 2, and 3, and I sat and I dragged my feet on that, and I don't know about you, but me doing my inventory, I felt like I was turning my insides out. It was nauseating, and I dragged my feet on that. But I eventually did get finished with that, and no, I wasn't cured. You know what I got to recognize is that there was a lot of things in Allison's life that I was complete. I was the column floor. You know, what were the mistakes I made in my life, and how was I contributing? I am the greatest obstacle to my own happiness. I know that to be true today. You know, I know that I am the one that is responsible and accountable to the life that I have. And if I'm not okay with that, then it behooves me, and I'm the one that gets to take the action to change the way that I'm living. And through the process of the steps, I started to clear away the wreckage of the past. I started to entertain some new ideas. I not only, I didn't only have to act better than my feel, but I started to feel better as a result of starting to get to know who and what I really am. And I started to feel compelled and to start taking right action, to start wanting to talk to other people, that I was more interested in talking to the newcomer rather than just being annoyed by them all the time. You know, I had very little tolerance for people with less time than myself because I wanted to come up and grab you by the neck and just force you to do what I was doing. And when I was about 3 years sober, I found this thing called AA where I was learning the truth about my condition, that what I suffer from here is a spiritual malady. And I didn't know that. I'd always heard things like, you know, you have a disease, and it made me feel like, well, there's nothing you can do about a disease, right? My literature says that I suffer from a spiritual malady, and I came in with a broken spirit. And Alcoholics Anonymous has found a way to put me back together again. And I get to take actions today that help me do that. What happened in 1999, I had an AA brother then. His name was Mike, and he lived in Vegas, and he had lived in between San Diego and Vegas, and his name was Mike Finch, and he was like 31 years old, and he developed this illness, you guys, called Lou Gehrig's disease, and I saw what Mike and his wife went through as he had to, you know, he was given a death sentence. You know, it was a terminal illness. There's no cure for it. And I saw the pain and the fear that he went through and the direction our sponsor gave him to show up and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what was going to keep him in good stead while he faced what was to come. And I remember Mike went down to Mexico to try to get some treatments, trying to apply some new therapies. Nothing really took hold, and he passed away within 3 or 4 years. But what happens is, in my sponsorship, we used to get together once a month, every other weekend or so, and we'd either go down to San Diego or up in LA, and we'd play sports. We'd play volleyball, or we'd play basketball at our sponsorship, because, you know, my sponsor sponsored both men and women. And he always said, you know, there's nothing funnier than watching a bunch of self-centered people try to play a team sport. And it's true, and, you know, elbowing people and fighting over the ball during basketball. But I remember I was blocking Mike. I was defense on Mike when he was trying to shoot the ball. And he went to shoot the ball, and he fell on the ground, and he couldn't get up because his illness was progressing with Lou Gehrig's. And I just lost it. I couldn't stop crying. And my sponsor came over to Mike, and he says, "You need to get up off the ground. You know, you need to keep showing up for yourself and for the people you're an example to." And what I learned by my emotion that I couldn't control at that time is I had not made amends to my father. I had not worked through what I needed to work through because of what a horrible daughter I was when my father was ill. And as Mike's illness progressed and he became bedridden, before he became bedridden, he was in a wheelchair. And there were some guys from San Diego that he sponsored and a couple of guys out from Arizona and Tempe area. They came out to San Diego, and they had a house down there, and they used to drive Mike. He had gotten a van, and they would drive him up to the Pacific Group every Wednesday to go to the meeting there. And when I remember Mike got to speak at the Pacific Group the year that he died. And one of the things about Lou Gehrig's is you lose the inability to control your own emotions. And he just started crying at the podium. And so everybody would do this to try to get him to snap out of it. And like the group, the Pacific Group surrounded him and supported him. And the people there knew what he was doing and the example he was setting. And they supported him 100%, and they all showed up for him. It was really remarkable. So when he became bedridden and he could no longer leave San Diego, every Friday night, me and my sister would jump in the car, 5 p.m. at Kinko's. We'd get in the car and head down the 405, and we'd go to San Diego, and we'd take him a meeting. And then we'd turn around and come back and get home in the middle of the night on Saturday morning. And it was something we got to do to be of service to him, to try to give to him back what he gave to Alcoholics Anonymous. What I got to learn from that is that I got to be healed from the relationship with my father because of my inability to show up for him when I was drinking. And I'm forever grateful for that. You know, there's things we get to do in AA that you just don't know the results. And there's a lot of, oh God, I was about to use that word. I don't want to use that word miracle. There's a lot of things that happen here if you show up for your life. If you're willing to allow someone with some experience to give direction, and you don't know what's capable of happening in your life if you just show up and do the deal. And I got to have that experience, not of my own accord. I'm way too selfish to do something like that on my own. I am way not other-centered by nature. But I followed my sponsor's direction, and I'm forever grateful for that. In 1999, I got asked out on a date. It had been a while. 4 years. I was counting. And, you know, after I did my 4-step, and I looked at my sexual misconduct, it was very clear to me the damage and the destruction I bring into a relationship with a man. And I was quite frightened and apprehensive to get involved with anybody because I did not want to cause that kind of pain again to another person. That didn't work. I ended up marrying a sucker. But so in 1999, I went on a date with this active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a member of my home group. He had asked me out several times over the period of a few months. And I told my sponsor I'd really like to go on a date. And my sponsor said, "Are you willing to take direction to learn how to date?" And I said, "Yeah." And so that was the deal. I went out on a Saturday night after the family meeting, on Saturday night, a Pacific Group meeting. And we'd drive up the coast and go to a restaurant. And both my ex-husband and I learned how to court one another, how to behave, how to not get physical with one another until it was appropriate to do so. We learned to get to know one another, and we learned that We brought Alcoholics Anonymous into our life. And we ended up getting married a couple years later. I had left my sponsorship at that time, and I married this man. And then something happened, and maybe you've seen it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Boy meets girl on AA campus, and then all of a sudden AA meetings are not that much of a priority any longer. And remember I was talking about self-will earlier. You know, it was time for us to get a life out there. You know, we've been busy doing this AA thing forever now. It's time to get out there and go back to school and try to start a career and get busy. You know, I seem to ignore the fact that I have this thing called alcoholism. And I remember I was 17 years sober at a workshop that my sponsor did in Chicago. And I remember him saying, you know, if you're here and you're alcoholic, you might not know this, but you will always have this thing. And I was 17 years sober and I realized, oh my God, I'm always going to have this thing. It was a profound understanding, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But my ex-husband and I started to do this dance of untreated alcoholism. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous and our commitment to it started to get a little scarce. He dropped down to one meeting a week. I was doing two meetings a week, and then I had a baby in 2003. Oh, the joy of my life, my son. He's 18 today. And, you know, now I'm a busy mom. You know, I can't go to meetings. I got a kid. And let me tell you a little story. So in 2005, when my ex-husband started taking deployments to get away from me, he had worked in pharmaceutical sales, and then he went back into active duty with the Navy to take deployments. And he left in 2005 to go to Kuwait. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I need to be able to go to meetings. Now I'm stuck at home with a toddler. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And I had called a housekeeping service, a maid service, to come over. My husband said at the time, you know, a couple times a month, you can have someone come over and help clean the house. You can treat yourself to that while I'm gone. And I came over, the woman came over, she did a quote to do my house. I was not going to pay that amount of money, so I said no. But as she's leaving the house, she sees a copy of my 12 and 12 on the kitchen counter. She goes, oh, are you a 12-step program? I said, yeah, I'm a member of AA. She goes, you know what? So am I. She goes, you know, and I told her, because I like to complain to people, I said, no, my husband's gone, I have no babysitter, I can't go to meetings. What's your name again? Listen, no. And she goes, you know, I have a daughter named Sierra who does babysitting. Maybe she can babysit for you. Dude, that's what happened. So I would go down twice a week and pick up her daughter, gorgeous young lady who came over and treated my son like a king. And I felt safe leaving my son there so I could go to outside meetings. And, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen, right? And I'm so grateful for that. And, you know, my marriage never got any better. We were not practicing the principles in our life. It was a relationship of one-upmanship, and who can we blame today? Whose bigger fault is it today? And unfortunately, that's just where we were at. And I kept thinking I was superior to him because he was doing fewer meetings than I was. He didn't want to hear anything about it. It just was very ugly. I was demanding. I was obstinate. I was aloof. I did not let my husband get near me. You know, I just, emotionally, he couldn't get near me. And I blamed him for everything and the reason for my unhappiness. And so we did that dance and we moved to Arizona. We went back to LA for a while. We moved to Pennsylvania when he took a corporate job with Merck Pharmaceuticals. And his family was all up there and nothing got any better. And it was back that time I started talking to my old sponsor, Wayne, again, you know. And I asked Wayne for some help and he said, you know, the people I sponsor and the people in my group in Chicago, we're all going to Founders Day in Akron. Can you get there? And my thought is, are you kidding me? That's a 6-hour drive. Of course I can. Of course I can. I'll do that. Thank you for taking my call. And up until that point, he had given me a phone list of his home group in Chicago. He said, you need to call the people on this list. Start doing your 11-step as outlined by the St. Francis Prayer in the 12 and 12. And call those people on that phone list for my home group in Chicago and start talking to them and check in with them every day. You know, it's amazing the level of accountability when you have people who know what you're doing. And I do that to this day. I love it. It keeps me on the straight and narrow, is checking in with people. I talk to them about my spiritual goal of the day, the line of the St. Francis Prayer I'm on every day. I love it. I highly recommend it. That's how much I love it. And I was doing that then. So when I got in my car, I told my husband at the time, I'm going to Akron. You're here with our son. I'm going to Akron. And he's like, had I known you would ever let that man sponsor you again, I never would have married you. So that should have told you what was going on then. And I went to Akron, and I met these people, and it was all these people where I recognized their voice because I had been talking to them on the phone. We went to Founders Day. My first trip at Founders Day, I'm put on a city bus with a script, and I'm doing a history tour of AA from a script driving around Akron. It was fantastic. And I got to meet these wonderful active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a wonderful time. And I went back to that sponsorship, and I got back into surrendering to AA as the way of life. You know, I don't know about you, but sloth is listed as one of the seven deadly sins in another book. It is a predominant character defect in my life, you guys. My lack of action on my own behalf, that puts me in a position to be hurt, I'll tell you. And I often blame other people for it, but it's my own sloth. So I'm starting to get active again. I'm in Pennsylvania. My ex-husband takes a deployment to London. He's gone for 18 months. And during that time, I had a shoulder surgery. I went to the International Convention in San Antonio, Texas, 2010. And I'm talking to my sponsor. You know, my husband had sent me a letter, and he said, you are mentally ill. And unless you seek some help, when I get back, I don't see how I can stay married to you. And it said some other things, but you get the point. And I called my sponsor, Wayne. I said, this is what's going on. He said, just put it down. He goes, here's what I want you to do, Allison. Every time you have an interaction with your husband over the phone, I want you, and if you are disturbed, you need to do an inventory, right? So whenever I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. And I knew that step 10 was going to help me see the clarity of that, and that's what I did. Every time I was disturbed by my interaction with him, I did a 10 step. And here's what I learned, you guys. I was just at fault for the destruction of that marriage as that man was. That he was married to a woman who was aloof and distant, who was demanding. I acted like a spoiled brat. My interactions with him were immature. I called him names. I gave him no respect for what he brought into that family. And so because I was able to take responsibility for what I did for the destruction of that relationship, by the time we finally divorced 3 years later, we got to then become friends. Because to both of us, it became incredibly important for us to be a united front for our kids. And I want to tell you a little bit about my younger son, because I mentioned I had two boys. I only gave birth to one. In 2005, when he was in Kuwait, my ex-husband was in Kuwait, I got a call from my family in Texas. The ism is alive and well in my family. And I got a call from them. My younger sister, who had a problem with narcotics and speed and things, she was in a bad place in her life, and she had had another child. This was her second child. He was 10 months old, and nobody in my family had seen him for a while. My sister was out running and gunning and doing things, and she had been spotted at a 7-Eleven peddling for cash. And one of my mother's coworkers went to that 7-Eleven, and she said, oh, I saw your daughter Lynn over at 7-Eleven, but there's no baby seat in the back seat of the car. Where's your grandson Christian? Well, nobody knew. And so I got a call about our concerns. And 3 weeks later, I got another call from my mother saying, you know, you need to turn on the news. It's Channel 2 News in Houston, because they found Christian. He's in foster care. And what I found out, I turned on the news on the internet, and he was a John Doe in foster care because he had been abandoned and left in a hotel room by the airport. Because my sister was doing what she had to do to get what she needed to do at that time. And the hotel staff turned him into foster care, and he was 10 months old at the time. And so I called the advocate for the court, and I knew some Al-Anons in Tempe, Arizona. One of them was an attorney in child and family law, and she helped give me some direction on how to pursue that. And so I took action, and I asked for custody of that. I was able to get a hold of my husband on base in Kuwait and say, hey, you know, I want to take custody of Christian. Are you okay with that? My ex-husband grew up in the very same circumstances. He has two siblings under the very same conditions that became his brother and sister. So he was absolutely all for it. And that's what I did. And it took a year and a half for Christian to come to our home. And during that time, he stayed in four foster homes. And one of those foster homes, the woman had committed suicide from an overdose. And so he had a little bit of a rough start, but he came to live with us when he was 2.5 years old. And I'll get it. So when I had moved back to LA by the time Christian came to live with us, and he was escorted there by Child Protective Services from Houston, and he just became a member of our family, you know. And my older son was 3 years old at the time. He was having none of that. He tried to kill that little kid much as he could. Christian's got permanent scars on his face because Robbie tried to scratch his eyes out on more than one occasion. You know, and in 2008, by the time we got to Pennsylvania, we got to formally adopt Christian as our child. And we just, you know, I just adore that child. Unfortunately, I think he's a lot like me. I see a lot of myself in him, and I'm saving him a seat, but we'll see. I mean, both of my kids are really good kids. You know, for all of you parents out there, you know how much, you know, you just can't express the love that you have for a child. There's nothing like it. And my kids made me a better person, you know, because kids, when they need something, they're not going to stop till you pay attention to them, much like I was when I got to AA. But, I love my children. They made my life bigger and wholer, you know, and I love them. And so my ex-husband and I, you know, we finally got divorced in 2013, and we got to be really good friends. And what happened is that we stayed a united front, and I mean, you know, we lived in the same neighborhood. So he was one street over, and the kids would just go between each house. And a couple years ago, the kids just started staying at his house more because he had a pool, he had a basketball hoop, he had a pool table, he had the man cave house, right? So and so they would stay at his house more often, but I would just walk over to his house, and I would make dinner. And we got along quite well, and my ex-husband started getting sick. You know, he started getting these pancreatic stents because he had all this fat accumulation in his pancreas and the medical stuff. And so every 4 months, 3 or 4 months, I'd be taking him over to Del Webb Hospital. He'd get a pancreatic stent replaced. And I knew that he had started drinking. I knew that by the time he got back from Afghanistan, and he had admitted to drinking. And I saw him drunk a couple times, which was quite hard to watch at the beginning, you know, because he had been sober 17 years. And so he had cut back on the drinking, but he started having all these medical issues. And then things got worse, you know. In 2017, in the fall, I had taken a business trip to Chicago, and I got a call. I was there less than 24 hours. I was sitting in a conference, and I got a call from the ICU at Del Webb saying that he was in the intensive care. And I got on a plane. I went back. I was his power of attorney, medical power of attorney. And I got there, and you know, this stent had dislodged, and he had developed sepsis. And they did not think he was going to survive. In 3 weeks of being medically induced coma, he ended up going into rehab for 6 weeks to learn to walk again. But he survived that. And that was in the winter of 2017. They also discovered sclerotic tissue on his liver. And they asked me, does he drink? Well, I know he used to drink, but I haven't seen him drink in a while. Well, he had been drinking all the time, you guys. I just didn't know it. And in the spring of 2018, he got a liver transplant. And I was able to be of service to him in the way that I should have been of service to him as his wife, right? So now I got to be a good friend. I got to communicate to his family who were in Pennsylvania, and I got to be of service to him, and I'm grateful I got to do that. Not one day since the day we separated did I ever think that I'd want to get back together with him. Don't get me wrong. I was very clear through the process of the 10th step that we were not compatible as a married couple, but I could be of service to another person who was the father of my children, and he was a good dad. And unfortunately, what we came to find out at the end of 2019 is that he had never stopped drinking. He had continued to drink, and that new liver didn't tolerate that. And on the day after Christmas 2019, he was so jaundiced that he went to the emergency room at the hospital in Phoenix, and that's when he got busted, when they're like, your liver, the enzymes in your liver, you've been lying. And you guys, the hospital basically said, how dare you take this liver and do this when you cost somebody else a life because you had the privilege of taking this liver. They would not take another call from him. They said, you can go see your primary care. We're done with you. And I'm not saying that was the wrong thing for them to do either. I had no problem with that at all. And that's what happened. So they gave him a year to live, and he was dead within 7 weeks. You know, he died on February 21st of 2020, and, you know, we got to be there. I got to keep him on support till his mother could come down, and we got to be together and help send him off, and his kids got to be present for that. And, you know, on the day that I was told that he was not going to survive, it was on a Tuesday, and we took him off of support on Friday, I went home to... And my kids got home from high school, and I told my son, my older son, I said, your dad's not coming home again. And he said, he just sat there for a minute, and he stared at this, in front of him, and he said, I've been waiting 2 years for this to happen. He goes, but that's okay, I got a plan, I'm going to join the service after graduation, da-da-da-da-da. And, but my kids had been in this environment where they watched their father falling on the floor, calling 911, having the fire department show up frequently. You know, I was about to get up at a podium one night, and 30 minutes before that was to happen, I got a call from my son, the ambulance is coming again, dad's on the floor. And I said, I can't come home right now. I go, do you know where his go bag is? He said, yes, I do. I said, I'll go to the hospital as soon as I can. And so my kids knew what was going on, you know, and I... What that did for us is that we got to talk honestly about what alcoholism looks like. You know, I have alcoholism, and this is what my life looks like. This is your dad has alcoholism, and this is what his life looks like, and that's what happens. So we got to talk about that openly, and my kids have been terrific. So that we buried him at Arlington National Cemetery 2 weeks ago, you guys. We had to wait for the pandemic to be over, and we got to send him off with the gun salute, taps, you know, the caisson and the marching band down through the cemetery is absolutely awesome. And my kids get to see the service that their dad did. And I hope my kids go into the service too. I'm just throwing that out there. I hope they do. But through that time, I got to be a service to my kids, and I still do. We have a very strong relationship, me and my children. And, you know, none of this would be possible if it wasn't for the direction of my sponsor. I love my sponsor with every fiber of my being, and I hope you love your sponsor the same. He is a man that has changed my life. You know, I have a sponsor that's willing to give me his time as much as it takes to help me understand how to live AA as a way of life, how to understand how alcoholism shows up in my life, how important it is as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to take responsibility for sharing this message with the next man that comes along. Carrie and I were out hiking on the sand today, you know, and I get a call from my sponsor. There's the fiance of a guy I know in AA, and she needs some help. I need you to give her a call. I'm going to give her your number. You need to talk to her. Carrie, I'm going to take a call from this girl. We're hiking in the sand. So I'm on the phone with this woman I've never met with 6 years of sobriety who's looking for some help and getting to talk to her, and I call my sponsor back. Okay, this is what I said, and this is what I did. What do I do? How do I handle this that she talked about? Well, did you ask for this? I mean, I'm 29 years sober, you guys. I still need direction in my life. I still get to learn how to be a better member of AA, how to apply the tools I've been given, how to share my experience, strength, and hope with each other, because I love working with people today. I know that there's always more to learn, and I have a God in my life that I found because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was new and people used to say, you know, I remember we'd all get up at the podium, what's God's will for me today? I don't worry about that at all. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a program of action outlined in our text. I have the direction from my sponsor as a result of his understanding of that text that gives me a purpose in my life. And because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, I am in the presence of that power that I need in my life. I don't have to go looking for God anymore. I found him because I am a member here. And I feel a sense of purpose. What does it say in the beginning of the 12 and 12? AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can enable the sufferer to stop drinking and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Something like that. And I feel whole today. I feel like I get to have a life of my dreams. I have hope in my life today. I still get to do inventories on things I'm afraid of, but I get to get past that fear and take direction anyways. I'm going back to school for a master's degree in a couple weeks. I am afraid. But I'm excited, too, because I get to do it. I don't get to think about what I wish I could do. I actually get to take action and do it. I'm part of a group of alcoholics in my sponsorship line that are all doing that. And I am inspired by their commitment to being the best they can be and being the person they believe that God wants them to be. And I believe that for myself, and I believe that for you, too. So thank you for allowing me to be a part of your meeting tonight. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much.